Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo, and we apologize for last night not being on. We had a terrible computer virus and crack down there.
It just froze everything up.
Crashed everything, and we weren't able to do last night's program. But we're here tonight, and we thank everybody for listening to last week's show.
And we thank our computer guy for helping us.
Yeah.
We don't know what we'd do without him. I'm sure you have one out there that you're devoted to as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we thank Dave Osborne so much for his help. But I want to talk about, we got some union issues tonight to talk about, but I wanted to mention before we go any further, I wanted to talk about last night's debate a little bit because, man, I was so surprised. I think I was surprised. You know, finally, Obama came back, and, you know, he looked like a boxer out there, and it was great. You know, he and Romney were going at it, and, you know, it's the way it should be, you know, a real, you know, kick it.
Drilling down.
Yeah, you know, kick your nuts and go, you know, and that, I was really happy to see that. And, you know, that's the way it should be. I mean, Not so much that I care for either candidate that much, but damn it, you know, when you're fighting for your job, you know, and you're fighting for your country, and you're fighting, you know, you're the most important man in the world, and you're fighting to be the most important man in the world. I mean, it's good to see a great battle like that. And I'm hoping that Monday, which is the next debate, will be even a bigger battle.
That'll be on foreign policy.
Yeah, and I really think that I'm looking forward to seeing that. And I talked to about three or four people today in different, you know, walks of life, but primarily, I was very surprised at how many, you know, for the people that listened to the debate, they watched it, they were surprised, and they. People today are really zoning in on this thing. You know what I mean? They're not getting around, and I think that these debates are very
important. The two people that I talked to felt annoyed by both candidates, that they felt they were both superficial and it was just blah blah blah.
But
I'm just telling you what they said. I didn't necessarily agree with that. I felt that Romney. Other than talking points and sort of like topic sentences,
right.
If he were writing an essay, that's all he'd have. He'd have topic sentences, but he never builds a case.
Exactly.
You know, he never
goes beneath
the topic sentence.
I agree with you.
If I were a Romney supporter, if I were a Republican, I'd be very frustrated by that. I'm not a Republican, and I would never support anybody like Romney because their whole outline I find to be very disturbing. But I find them to be topic sentence people, talking points people with no depth to their case.
It's so true. And you listen to the got Rush Limbaugh and a couple other conservative talk show hosts, and man, I'll tell you, their argument. Against Obama's case last night, even they gave Obama the credit for winning that one and criticized Romney's presence. But the thing that bothered me most about last night's debate was that I enjoyed watching the fight. It was a good fight. I thought it was a good fight. Obama took it to him and called him a liar, called him a shit. And that was important, you know, that Romney had to be put in his place. But at the same time, there were some very some big gaps with Obama's
defense of himself.
Defense, you know.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems was the problem that was in Libya.
No, that was the least problem, actually.
Well,
I felt it was the problem. I didn't think it was the biggest problem.
The biggest problem was
when he was asked about his vision for the next 4 years.
Hmm.
And he seemed to fade away on that. Like,
yeah, that's not good.
Know.
Yeah, you're right about that.
You know, it was like, come on.
That's
guy.
Where you need to be strong. What's going to happen?
What's
we know what's been done. What are you going to do?
Yeah, and that's the whole crux of the Romney attack, is that, you know, you've had 4 years of a dismal, recovery. You're going to have 4 more years of the same thing. But, you know, looking at Romney's plans and Ryan's plans, those are horrendous. Those are horrible. And you can't...
Oh, guaranteed to have 97% suffering.
And 50% unemployment and 50%, you know, a misery, you know, or more. You know, maybe the only people that would benefit would be the 1%.
That's right.
Right? And, you know, it's a sickening debate when you look at it from that way. So, you know, Obama wins, but at the same time,
he has some real weaknesses.
He has some real weak points. And I've criticized, if you go to my website, lasteelshow.org, you'll see tremendous number of criticisms we've had on Obama since he first took office. However, you know, my Republican, my arguments against the Republicans have been overwhelmingly, negative, and I can't see any positive aspect to it.
What I see is from the president down to whoever is running for a Republican office, it's the same superficial chatter.
It is.
With no doubt.
Totally. We here in Connecticut are suffering from a really horrible election year. We have a couple of real credents running for office. We got a lady named McMahon, who's the chairman of the
wrestling.
The founder of the WWE, the World Wrestling Entertainment. She's a nightmare from hell. And you got Murphy, who's a weakling from Weakling World. You know what I mean? It's like the guy's a horrible candidate, a Democratic candidate. And he's been in office for 6 or 7 years.
He's finally starting to seem a little bit stronger,
but he got a real
slow start.
He did, and because she attacked him on all on many, many areas. And, you know, you had to start thinking, what a miserable representative this guy's been. And at the same time, you know, how much worse would this woman be as a senator?
Oh, far worse, far worse, far worse.
So,
but,
you know, you're lost. And then you get, I won't drag up the dredges of society, but you got a guy named Rohrbach running for Congress. You know, it was a total dweeb and a horrible...
A toady.
Horrible.
He's a toady.
A toady. And you got this Esther Brooks, who's... You know,
no,
she seems
not
strong.
Her name is not Esther
Brooks.
Her name is Esty.
Who's, you know, rather, you know, moderate. I don't know what she is, but...
I don't dislike
but, you know,
her. I think she's
again,
okay.
Again, you know, looking at the two...
I like her,
actually.
I mean,
no question, you know, she's a stronger candidate.
She's head and shoulders above him.
And
I liked her when she, even though originally she didn't get the endorsement from AFSCME, I liked her presentation speech, and I would have supported her.
Oh, absolutely. She liked her a lot. But, you know, AFSCME supported Chris Donovan, who was, you know...
A former union guy and had done a lot for the union.
He may have been a great guy, but, Jesus, his whole campaign was under federal indictment. So, I mean, there wasn't a very good choice for supporting him. And, of course, he dropped out of the race, but he lost the primary to...
Elizabeth, I think I would put my faith in her, possibly. Yeah, I thought she did a
what we know of her, you know, that's the best we can
do. A great job. I like her, so
finally the union is behind her, so that's good. But But all in all, it's pretty dismal. Your choices are pretty dismal. And unfortunately, Obama is not the greatest of wonder boys. But at the same time, he's so far above Romney.
Oh, God,
oh,
yes.
My God.
There's no comparison
If you can even come close, it's not. I mean, if you want to save the system the extent that we can, and Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, even Obamacare, you know, whatever comes about by that, I think we're on the right track here to the extent that we can. The Bush years, and of course, if you go back to my website again, lasteelshow.org, you'll see, since 2004, I've documented the nightmares of the Bush administration. And I have a number of people that are documenting, using my work for their own research and so on. But, you know, it was absolutely a frightening time period.
But let's look, talking about the past. Let's
look at the future.
At the future, and maybe this article will give you pause to think about how you're going to vote. This is called Here's Your Roadmap for the Up-and-Coming Budget Obstacles Course, and this is from the AFL-CIO website, and it's by Kelly Ross. After the election, Congress will make some high-stake decisions about jobs and taxes that could have serious consequences for working families and the economy. A new report by the Economic Policy Institute should serve as a working families guide to the post-election debate. Here are some decisions facing Congress when they return. The federal unemployment benefits program expires at the end of December. The Bush tax cuts also expire automatically, and Congress will have to decide whether to extend them for the middle class or also extend them for the richest 2% of Americans. Thanks to last summer's debt ceiling agreement, across-the-board budget cuts are scheduled to take effect in January 2013. If Congress makes the wrong call on these high-stakes decisions, we could have another recession in 2013. The Economic Policy Institute recommends a sensible principle to guide these high-stakes budget decisions. Continue the policies that are most effective in creating jobs and have the most bang for the buck, and discontinue the policies that don't work and waste money. Which are the ones that don't work? Well, cutting taxes yet again for the richest 2% of Americans is one of the least effective things you can do with $1 trillion. About the only policy with less bang for the buck is cutting estate taxes. If we have a recession, it will not be because we stopped giving tax cuts to the rich people. What policies have the most bang for the buck? EIP recommends undoing the debt ceiling agreement from last summer, which threatens short-term job creation and long-term economic growth. The next most effective thing Congress could do are to extend the unemployment benefits program, invest in infrastructure, avoid layoffs at the state and the government levels. The EPI concludes that, that's the Economic Policy Institute, replacing ineffective policies with cost-effective fiscal support would also reduce the budget deficit. True deficit hawks who also seek to alleviate persistently high unemployment would be extraordinarily vigilant in ensuring that only very effective fiscal support measures were preserved in up-and-coming negotiations over the fiscal obstacle course and the cost-effective economic policies replace ineffective policies. That's a lot of garbledygook. EPI is right. This is what they said. We are heading for a fiscal obstacle course, not a fiscal cliff. We risk very little harm to our economy by letting tax cuts for the richest 2% expire on schedule. But we do jeopardize our economic future by letting the richest 2% bully the rest of us into making bad decisions. And there's also, it says, read the full analysis. Oh, I guess there's an even longer article if you go to this website. economic impacts of expiring tax cuts, spending cuts, and policy recommendations.
I thought Obama was right on the money. I mean, what he said made sense, because what Romney said made no sense.
There's nothing deeper than a topic sentence for Romney. He never builds a case.
He never did.
He has a very creative topic sentence, but he never builds the case for anything.
He never gives you any facts. He never gives.
Because he doesn't have any.
Now, what is it? What the hell is he going to cut? And the only thing that he's going to cut.
Well, we know he's cutting money for public television.
Well, we know he's going to. His plan is to cut money to reduce the reduction on a mortgage deduction for middle class Americans.
Since he has his five houses now.
For all of these things that we benefit from, all right, he plans to cut, all right? And, he's going to cut a few billion dollars from the corporate bandwagon as well. But that's bullshit next to what we're going to suffer. So, you know, it's a typical Republican crap, all right? And it's beyond me how Republicans...
Here it is. Tell us what you think. How do we fix what's wrong with the U.S. economy? Okay, this is part four in the four-part series that we read. Number one is, how do we fix the U.S. economy? We put America back to work. We restore workers' bargaining power. Make things in America again and rein in Wall Street. And the result is productivity growth, wage growth, and consumer demand and business investment will drive that. But here, let's read what they have to say in this article. To fix what's wrong with the U.S. economy, we have to replace the failed low-wage economic strategy of the past 30 years with a high-wage strategy for shared prosperity. I agree with that. The first step in such a high-wage strategy is to put America back to work, because high unemployment keeps wages down. Our goal should be full employment, meaning everybody who wants to work should be able to find a decent job. We can't allow the unfounded fear of inflation to be used as an excuse to keep unemployment high and wages low. Full employment will require much higher levels of investment in education, clean energy, and infrastructure, which is the foundation for long-term economic productivity and growth. The Economic Blueprint, Prosperity Economics by Jacob Hacker and Nate Lowenthal, recommends an annual investment in infrastructure of $250 billion for the next 6 years. I agree with that. I think our infrastructure has fallen apart. The level of investment will require more revenue from people and corporations that benefited from the failed economic policies of the past 30 years. Absolutely. They need to pay up. We can do that by allowing the Bush tax cuts for the richest 2% to expire, taxing overseas corporations as income the same way we tax domestic income, so corporations no longer can lower their tax bills by shifting jobs and income overseas,
right.
Imposing a modest tax on financial speculation.
Right.
That was Ralph Nader's idea.
He said even a penny per share would create billions of dollars of revenue.
Taxing investment income, capital gains, and dividend the same way we tax labor income, wages, and salaries, and allowing estate and gift tax cuts to expire. The second step of a high-wage strategy is to restore workers' ability to bargain collectively, which will raise wages, reduce economic inequality, fuel consumer demand, and help rebuild the middle class to guarantee that workers who want to join a union and bargain collectively can do so. We need urgent reform of our unfair labor laws. We can also reconnect wages with productivity by ensuring that every job is a good job, raising and indexing the minimum wage, extending minimum wage and overtime protection to more workers, and strengthening investment in workers' education and skills training. The third step of a high-wage strategy is to make things in America again. We can do that by eliminating our trade deficit, ending overvaluation of the dollar, combating currency manipulation by our trading partners, eliminating all incentives for offshore in our tax code, enhancing Buy America safeguards aggressively, enforcing our trade laws and promoting a global New Deal to help our trade partners rely on domestic incomes rather than trade surpluses as a source of economic growth. The fourth step of a high-wage strategy is to shrink our bloated financial sector and make it serve the real economy again. We can do that by re-regulating Wall Street, eliminating the tax benefit for leveraged buyouts, and imposing a modest tax on financial speculation. Doing all these things would restore a virtuous circle, in which rate growth leads to healthy consumer demand, which encourages business investment and which drives productivity, which, if we have strong unions and low unemployment, leads us back to dynamic wage growth. Obviously, such a strategy will encounter intense opposition from Wall Street and the 1% who benefit economically from the status quo and wield outside influence over our political system. Fixing our economy also will require political reform to loosen the stranglehold of money over our politics and breathe new life into our democracy. However, the failure of the economic strategy of the past 30 years has shown us there is no good alternative. We no longer can rely on household borrowing, real estate bubbles, tech bubbles, stock bubbles, or any other kind of bubble to fuel our economic growth. We must forego a new model of economic growth, one in which we must forge a new model of economic growth, one in which everybody who wants to work can find a decent job, everybody who wants to join a union is able to do so, and working people can afford to buy the things they make. We make things in America again. The U.S. economy produces as much as it consumes, and prosperity is broadly shared. I agree with all those rays.
Yeah, you
too.
Yeah, that was good.
Especially that we need to invest in infrastructure, I think. It's so important.
It's critical. And the Republican Party has denied all of Obama's plans to do that.
That's right.
Which is really quite surprising. I was really surprised.
Let's see what else there is here.
Yeah. Romneyism, you know, makes you sick. Totally makes you sick when you look at it for what it really is. All right, let's keep going. Jobless rate drops to 7.8%.
Yeah,
that happened last week. But, you know, I think it's significant to look at this because the Republicans are really bashing the shit out of this and saying that, those rates were fixed and so on and so forth. But let's read that and see what it really means.
Let's see what this woman has to say.
Let's start. You want to?
Unemployment rate declined from 8.1% to 7.8% in August. So, read that. Leo's going to read this article.
Yeah. This was back a couple of days back. It was back on the 5th of October. But, you know, it's still important to note this because I think that the unemployment rate declined from 8.1 in August to 7.8 in September with 114,000 jobs added last month. You know, the problem with this is we were attacking the Bush administration for adding 100,000 jobs and thought it was such a joke. And you know, I got issues here, but with 114,000 jobs added, according to figures released this morning, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, there has been a positive private sector job growth for more than 2.5 years. AFL-CIO President Richard Tomka says this morning's jobs report confirms that the economy is finally beginning to build some momentum as we work to dig out the devastating deep hole that President Obama inherited from George W. Bush and generational flood policies. Now we need the President and Congress to build on this momentum and keep their focus on job creation, including by passing the American Jobs Act. And the biggest numbers of the 114,000 jobs were in healthcare, transportation, and warehousing. The number of unemployed persons at 12.1 million decreased by 456,000 in September. Jobless rates for adult men stood at 7.3%, adult women at 7%. White workers also at 7%, a decline from all three groups since August. So, meanwhile, the unemployment rate for teenagers is 23.7%, African American workers is 13.4%, Hispanics 9.9%. Showed little change from the previous month. The number of long-term unemployed, those jobless for 27 weeks or more, dropped from 5 million to 4.8 million. While employment was dropped steadily this year, economists say the pace would be quicker if not for the long track record of the Republicans in Congress blocking legislation aimed to grow the economy, like President Obama's American Jobs Act, which would have created some 1.9 million jobs. According to Economic Policy Institute, Rebecca Thies, Republicans have continued to obstruct policies that would create jobs and more restore growth, with holding the middle class hostage to demands for more tax cuts to benefit the rich 2%. And we saw this in the debate last night. You know, Obama said he's trying to get it through.
Yeah.
You know, the Republicans block it.
Yeah.
You know, Thies points out President Obama's job creation policies.
Who pointed that out?
What?
Who pointed out?
Thies. I don't know who Thies is.
I don't know who he is.
Thies points out that President Obama's job creation policies, such as the Economic Recovery Act and the Rescue for the Auto Industry, were enacted before Republicans seized control of the House. These policies are responsible for the creation of millions of jobs in the aftermath of the Great Creation, of the Great Recession. She also notes that the American Jobs Act that Republicans blocked would have dropped the jobless rate by a full percentage point.
Wow.
Right? And you can go to her site at Obama Too Quiet on Job Creation Record, was her article. It says, jobs in economy, the focus of Wednesday's presidential debate with Trumka, says the debate unscored that on November 6th we face a clear choice about the future of our country. The austerity and deep spending cuts proposed by Governor Romney will gut essential services and leave the most vulnerable worse off. This was last week's debate that they had. And all pay for tax cuts for the richest 2%. In contrast, President Obama has laid out a concrete plan for shared prosperity policies based on investing in America and restoring our democracy. The labor movement is committed to the policies of prosperity economics, reforms that will unite and strengthen America by creating jobs, promoting economic security, and rebuilding our democracy. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, why don't we take a little music break while we try to
okay.
go to another site and bring you some more news.
That sounds good to me. So we'll be right back in about 2 minutes. Now let me go to Swagger. And I, you know, things get strange, you know, and we get a little weird when we're looking at last night's debate, for instance. You know, Romney was so outgunned, you know, and why Obama didn't really do it at the first debate was beyond me, but later I realized that there were only 37 lies Romney said inside of like less than 45 minutes in that debate. And I guess if I were Obama sitting there and going, holy cow, where is this guy coming from? An attack upon attack and lie upon lie upon lie. Where do I start? Where do I begin? You know, because it was totally unexpected, you know, from what Romney had been saying all along. And, you know, Romney is a pathological liar. I don't care what anybody says. He's a pathological liar. Whether Obama is, well, you know, maybe. But, I mean, being president of the United States, I think you got to be a pathological liar. But I'll tell you, when you look at what's happening now, you look at what George Bush got us into, the Republican Party got us into over those years. You know, all those years. We're looking in the face of darkness. We're looking at the void right now, about ready to fall in. And, you know, Obama got us out of this stuff. Gotta give him some credit. But, you know, but there's no way that Romney's going to be able to do it, not with his bankrupt policies. You know, we've had over 30 years of Republican policies, you know, with one short respite between 92 and 2000, where we had Bill Clinton.
Well, here's one. The bankers are at it again. CEO Group president walks off with $260 million after his bank loses 88%
of its
value.
And this is another failure of the Obama administration, not prosecuting these bastards, you know.
This is by Pat Garofalo.
But you don't hear anything from the Romney administration. The Romney's from talking about prosecuting banksters either.
No.
No.
Citigroup CEO Vikram Pandit abruptly resigned today, leaving the helm of the bank that he guided through the financial crisis of 2008. For his 5 years of leading Citi, Pandit will receive compensation, please, I hope you're sitting, in the neighborhood of $260 million. If no alterations are made to Pandit's compensation package, Citigroup will have paid him about $261 million in 5 years since he became CEO, including his personal compensation and about $165 million for buying his old lame partner's LP hedge fund in 2007 in a deal that led to his becoming CEO. The bank shut old lame soon after Pandit took the post, causing a $202 million write-down. But while Pandit made off like a bandit, shareholders were not so lucky. Via Matt Yaglis, here's Citigroup's stock performance since Pandit's takeover, and it gives a whole diagram of it. Overall, Citigroup lost 88% of its value under Pandit. Earlier this year, the Wall Street Journal dinged Pandit for having the pay package that was most detached from his company's performance, as a 3-year decline of 27% coincided with his making $43 million. The Dodd-Frank financial reform law gave shareholders the right to hold a non-binding vote on executive compensation, and Pandit was the first bank CEO to get tagged with a vote of disapproval. But, you know, why have a vote if it's non-binding? What good is that?
Yeah, it's totally ridiculous, you know. And,
at least I think so.
It is.
Silly.
It is. So, what else you got there, Lila?
Well, 50 children's bodies were found in an unmarked graveyard in a Florida school.
Read that one. That was pretty frightening, I thought, when I saw that.
That's pretty scary.
Very frightening.
This is from Live Leak. In an absolutely horrifying story, a forensics team found that a secret graveyard hidden behind a Florida reform school could be home to nearly 50 unidentified bodies of past students. Now families and former peers of the victims are speaking out to say the deaths were actually caused by abuse of school administrators. How terrifying.
Yeah.
The cemetery dates all the way back to the early 1900s and was actually already examined very recently in 2009. At the time, the investigators found 31 unidentified bodies, all of whom the state's Department of Law Enforcement said died of either the flu or in a fire. But after the University of Southern Florida anthropologist, Dr. Erin Kimmerly, recently took a closer look, she found 18 more bodies buried, which had remained undiscovered during the previous inspection. We found more burials within the current Mark Cemetery than we found burials that extend beyond that. There are children who came here and died for one reason or another and have just been lost in the woods. According to Kimmerly, there might also be a second secret cemetery segregated for black students, which means the number of buried bodies on the school's creepy grounds could actually be much higher. And the story only gets more horrible from there. Besides the fact that none of the bodies have been identified, now scary details about the dead potential causes behind the deaths are being revealed by the victims' former peers who say that they brutal beatings and whippings at the hands of the teachers were common in the 1960s. Oh, the whole thing is just so awful that I can barely wrap my head around it. The bodies of these kids have basically been lost for years with no apparent effort made to identify them. Oh, it's horrible. And the article just goes on. Oh, terrible, terrible. Terrible.
Yeah.
Let's see.
It happens. Horrible.
The last person to enter Parliament with honest intentions was Guy Fawkes. I mean, I don't know whether any of you remember. They celebrate Guy Fawkes Day in England. Please to remember the 12th of November, Guy Fawkes Day, tried to blow up the Parliament.
That was the movie V was about. But anyway, this is interesting. Why don't you read this?
Nine
supermarkets. We usually try to talk about GMO products.
What your grocer won't tell you. Oh, this is probably scary.
Yeah.
I probably won't want to go to the grocery store anymore. And this is from the Activist Post. Oh, here it is. We can go right down. You decide which of these supermarket secrets are acceptable and which... Whoops. What happened to that? Oh, dear. Sorry. I must have looked at an ad and it came on.
Yeah.
Okay. Which of the supermarket secrets are acceptable and which methods seem to be less than ethical practices? I'll start with number one and then you can read number two, Leo.
Okay.
Number one is shrinking packages. Yeah, that's true. Over the past several years, containers and food packages have gotten smaller, but they are trying to make up for losses in a bad economy or just greed. Food manufacturers are selling you less and they are selling these smaller packages at the same price. They'll shrink the product, but not the price for a while, and then when they add a few ounces back, they can market it as 20% more.
It's true. It's true. Expired food in the deli. The prepared food you buy from the deli comes off the shelves of the store, and they are picking the freshest options. Instead, they choose the food that are closest to their expiration date, saving themselves money, a better bet cooking for yourself. I can attest to this because I knew that, like, for instance, when they have a fresh lobster or when a place has cooked lobster,
yeah.
Well, because the damn thing's died, you know, and they have to, rather than lose them, what they do is they cook them, you know, and sell them out to you as cooked lobster, you know, right? Or fresh lobster or something, which is like, you know, they're dead. So go ahead.
Eye-level shelves are prime real estate. Food companies pay for product placement. The little-known companies and local fruit producers are often on the very top shelf or way down at the floor level because they can't afford to be right in the middle, where companies pay a stiff price to be close to your eyes and hands.
Suspicious lightning.
Lighting.
Or lighting, I'm sorry. Your grocer may be making their wares more attractive with colored bulbs. In most cases, this is actually against the law, but is reportedly difficult to enforce. Red lights offer the meat counters over the meat counters, or green lights over the vegetables can make the food look better and make you spend more. And dirty produce.
There are no restrictions on, I never thought about this, on who can fumble through the produce section. But not only are you taking home products that's been handled by other customers, it was put out there by store employees, the person who unpacked the boxes, and even the persons who picked it, so there's no telling who has touched the produce or where their hands have been. So if you need a stack, offer something quick out of the produce department. Be certain you wash it thoroughly, even if it's organic.
Yeah, sure. And other supermarket secrets that you don't know about. Here are a few other supermarket secrets you probably don't know about. Freezing food. Did you know that what you think is fresh could be months old? And after being kept in a freezer for months to prevent aging, breads are finally thawed to put on display. This is known as part baking. Similarly, meat is frozen before reaching the supermarket, but then thawed to look fresh in the market freezer. The problem? This opens a wider door to bacterial exposure and growth. Think twice before stocking up on meat, only to freeze it. And avoiding Mondays. Well, this is good. Deliveries to supermarkets don't typically happen on weekends. This means that stuff purchased on Mondays is likely 7 days old. Wednesday is generally when supermarket shelves are stocked with fresh products. So avoid Mondays.
Huh.
And use by date. While it's scary to think about, you could actually see the same products you saw a month ago with a new use by date sticker on it. The manufacturer use by date can't be changed, but retailers can add their own use by date sticker numerous times until the product is sold. Grocery stores need those profits. And the cold line. There is something called a cold line, also known as the load limit, where eggs are kept. The cold line is a colored line in a dairy section painted on by manufacturers. If you see eggs stacked above this line, know that these eggs can sweat, igniting possible bacterial growth. So there's a cold line.
I've never heard of that before, did you?
No. I have to look at that. Those are essential things that you got to really look at in these stores. Kind of frightening, huh?
Yeah.
So anyway. Oh, a Romney-Ryan tax plan. Let's look at this.
Yeah.
Says, for a detailed explanation of how the Romney-Ryan tax plan is able to cut taxes by $5 trillion without exploding the deficit or requiring tax hikes on the middle class, simply click the button below. Okay. Oh, that's probably the joke.
Yeah, there isn't any.
Says Mitt Romney has ducked and sidestepped every attempt to get the details of his plan, which stick the middle class in tax cuts favored millionaires and billionaires.
That's a joke.
Don't keep doing that.
It's a joke.
Okay. So, this one was cool because I don't know if you heard about this, but I laughed when I read it because I heard on the news first. I said, director of soup kitchen, furious after Paul Ryan showed up uninvited, washes clean pans for a photo op, and then leaves. And if you might have seen this right before his debate with Biden.
With Joe Biden.
Yeah, this is Mail Online, which the UK was a British paper.
Oh, do they have? They showed the picture of him.
Yeah. He's watching. This is. It says a 15-minute feel-good photo op at an Ohio soup kitchen for Paul Ryan has turned into a trouble, ill will, the charity director claims. Brian J. Antle, the president of the Mahoning County St. Paul DePaul Society, said the Republican vice president candidate showed up uninvited, scrubbed pots and pans that were already clean, and posed for pictures with his family on Saturday. Mr. Antle says he was never informed that Ryan was coming and wouldn't have granted him permission to make a campaign stop there, he added. And he told the Washington Post that he worried that some of his private donors would be polarized by the visit and stop donating money. He claims he would have the same qualms over a visit from President Obama. And he had asked for permission. Had he asked for permission, I wouldn't have been granted. But I certainly would have given him wash clean pans and then take a picture, he told the newspaper. So Ryan was washing clean pans. He just walked in there, grabbed the hose, and started washing clean pans.
That's ridiculous. What a show off.
He put in
a day of hard work at a soup kitchen.
15 minutes. He put on aprons and rubber gloves and started washing dishes that appeared to be ready clean, and all in front of photographers and TV cameras. The trip to St. Paul's soup kitchen came after a town hall meeting at Youngstown State University. It was a last-minute stop before the Wisconsin congressman left town. Both Romney and Obama are fiercely battling the key swing state in Ohio, where polls give the president the lead. And Romney and Obama are fiercely battling the swing states, yeah. Okay. So we all know that. But, you know, the frightening part about it is that, you know, they're trying to get away with it, you know, trying to get away with showing up. What a great humanitarian this bastard really is.
Yeah.
Huh?
He isn't a humanitarian.
He's a schmuck. Oh, I don't know.
Pretty sad. He has to do act like he cares.
I'm trying to think of what I would like to talk about the last 10 minutes.
Kind of a phony.
Here we go. All right, this is kind of important here to me. I've tried to bring up this news, but there hasn't been very much about Fukushima and the radiation news lately. You know, because it's so horrible. You know, nobody's actually been reading about it, but this one is important because it says, ground under Fukushima Unit 4 is sinking, structure on the verge of complete collapse. It's by Natural News. You want to read this?
No, you go ahead. You start.
Okay. Though the mainstream media has long since abandoned the issue, the precarious situation of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power facility in Japan is only continuing to worsen. According to a prominent Japanese official during the recent interview, the former Japanese ambassador to both Switzerland and Senegal explained that the ground beneath the plant's Unit 4 is gradually sinking, that the entire structure is very likely on the verge of complete collapse. This is highly concerning as Unit 4 currently holds more than 1,500 spent fuel rods, and a collective 37 million curies of deadly radiation that, if released, could make much of the world completely uninhabitable. As some Natural News readers will recall, Unit 14 contains the infamous elevated cooling pool that was severely damaged during the catastrophic earthquake and tsunami that struck on March 11, 2011. And according to the Secretary of former of Japanese Prime Minister, the ground beneath Unit 4 has sunk by about 31.5 inches since the disaster. Wow. And this sinking has taken place unevenly.
Seawater is going to pour in there.
Yeah. if the ground continues to sink, which is unexpected, which it expected to, or if another earthquake or even as low as a magnitude 6 occurs in the region, the entire structure could collapse, which would fully drain the cooling pool and cause a catastrophic meltdown. Now, 1,500 spent fuel rods could cause the entire Earth to be destroyed.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. Amazing. And anyway, if you...
It's pretty scary. Well, what are they going to do about it?
Well, it says if Unit 4 collapses, the worst-case scenario will be a meltdown, and a resilient fire in the atmosphere that will be the most unprecedented crisis that man has ever experienced. Nobody will be able to approach the plants, as all will have melted down and caused a big fire, says Matura Maruda during the interview. Many scientists say if Unit 4 collapses, not only will Japan lie in ruin, but the entire world will also face serious damages. And because there are 31 nuclear units of a similar type to Unit 4 in the U.S., the American government has now been downplaying the disaster to protect its own reputation. This is, in fact, the primary reason why so little has been reported on the severity of Fukushima following the disaster. The American empire, in other words, does not want the world, nor the American people, to know that there is a possibility of literally dozens of Fukushima situations occurring on American soil should the right disaster situation arise. Now, buddy, I'll tell you, if that doesn't scare your ass, I don't know what will.
They don't say much about it.
You're not hearing about it. I try to look for this stuff constantly, and there's not a lot of news on it. And, not new news, you know. This is something new. This is another thing. It says, don't celebrate yet, but a grassroots victory against GMO deception is now inevitable.
Mm.
The battle against genetically modified food organisms being secretly engineered in our food now has only one possible outcome: victory for the people and defeat of the corporate quack scientists and the outrageously dishonest and sinister biotech industry that has shoved GMO down our throats for a decade or more. In terms of victory, I'm not just talking about Proposition 37, although that could very well be a turning point that accelerates the consumer victory. But even if Proposition 37 doesn't pass, the end of the line for hidden GMOs in our food is fast approaching. The word is out. People are getting informed. There are absolutely no going back to the era of GMO ignorance and the truth about GMOs causing cancer, infertility, and organ damage, and other deadly health problems. Is circulating everywhere. Even Whole Foods is now teaching its own employees more detail about GMO so that they can better answer customer questions about GMO. GMO labeling laws are in the planning stages in several states across the country. Representative Dennis Kucinich has already introduced a national GMO labeling law called the Genetic Engineered Food Safety Act, or H.R. 6635. Monsanto is on the run from activists. Honest doctors and scientists everywhere are waking up and speaking out against GMO. Food retailers like Green Polka Dot Box have already abandoned GMO, and they now run an online store that's virtually free of genetically modified products. And what really is fascinating is that both organic-loving progressives and liberty-loving conservatives are loudly speaking out against GMOs for the same reasons.
Hmm.
You want to read that?
Just show me where we
are. Right
here. You'll just have to get the computer to me. Think about it. What other issue has the widespread support of churches, environmentalists, health experts, food gurus, farmers, and natural health consumers? Only one issue: GMO. Our victory against the scourge of GMO is now inevitable. We have passed the tipping point of consumer awareness that Jeffrey Smith has long been advocating. The number on the No on 37 campaign can only resort to lies now. They can't debate the facts on GMO. Their dishonest advertisements in California dare not even mention the term genetic engineering. They have desperately and pathetically turned to a campaign of obfuscation and confusion because they simply have no defense against common sense GMO labeling now. GMOs should be labeled just like facts, sugars, proteins, calories, and ingredients. It's a basic common sense, and everybody knows it. High sales of GMO is based entirely on ignorance. GMOs are an industry based entirely on ignorance. GMOs are the only product whose retail success is based entirely on the fact that consumers have no idea what they were buying. GMOs are the only products that people accidentally purchase. Think about it. Nobody actively goes to the grocery store and seeks out the foods with GMOs in them. No food company declares now made with GMO on the label or the product they make. No grocery store advertises, we sell GMO in our store. GMOs are only purchased accidentally by consumers. Nobody buys them on purpose. They buy them out of ignorance. And when that ignorance is transformed into knowledge, nobody wants to eat GMOs, especially not when it's killing the rats and giving them massive tumors like the ones in these pictures that they show. Awareness is the solution. Resistance is victory. Because GMOs only succeed through consumer ignorance, education is the most effective solution. The scam is over. That's why the single most important thing you can do right now to help defeat Monsanto and the GMO biotech industry is to spread the word about GMOs. GMOs are poison.
Support Proposition 37 here in California.
Yeah, and maybe that will spread.
Yeah.
We just have a couple of minutes here. Action items to help defeat GMOs. If you're looking for other things you can do to join in this victory against poisonous genetically engineered foods, there are some action items. Visit the GMO article page on Natural News. This page is updated each time they publish a new article on GMOs. Join in the National Phone Bank to call California registered voters and help educate them about GMOs and Proposition 37. Share popular GMO videos such as A Rat's Tale, What is a GMO, or even my recent children's song and music video, Just Label It, a great song for kids, they love singing it. Make a donation to the Yes on 37 campaign in California. Read up on GMOs. Watch the highly informative genetic roulette movie produced by Jeffrey Smith. We haven't seen that.
We'll have to look at that.
Whoops.
Okay.
And more importantly, the last thing, don't buy any GMOs if you can help
it. Don't buy any if you can find it. If you make, you know, almost anything that's made out of wheat is a GMO. Anything
corn.
Made out of corn is a GMO. Anything that is processed. Okay, any processed foods, GMO, anything unless it says organic on it is a GMO, all right? So, you know, that's why we want them labeled. And like every other country that banned them, we'll ban them as well. So I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Please join me tomorrow night when we venture into the fourth dimension.
And have a great evening, folks.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, good night, everybody. And have a good evening.
Rose up.